Welcome back to America Trends Podcast. I'm Larry Rifkin, and my friend, my colleague, John Krofcik is with me. John?
Yeah, how are you doing today?
Good. And we are on the prowl once again.
Ooh, yes, we
are. For the big stories of some year into the future. We don't chase today's headlines,
that's
John.
Right.
You know that.
We're looking over the horizon.
Over the fog and the haze and the smoke of the present day. Subjects that we find interesting are ones that will be on the front page in something like, I don't know, in the year 2525. Remember that song?
2525.
Who sang that song?
Man is still alive.
In the year 2525.
Who sang that? Animals?
Sager and Evans.
Oh, okay. I remember.
I forgot about them, but I just somehow it came back into my head because I was a disc jockey. So, of course, Sager and Evans in the year 2525.
Wow. Well, and will man still be alive?
You got to come find me if I'm wrong about anything that we are bringing to you, or if we say this is going to be a trend.
That's
or there's
right.
certainty about this. So come find me if
they
I'm wrong.
They can dig us up.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I'll be involved with my next career, which is probably worm farming, or I'll be walking in circles in a small room.
You never
somewhere.
Know. Now with the, you may be around.
I don't know. Well, I've got to tell you, honestly, a sad story, but it's true. And none of us wishes it upon ourselves or anyone we know or anyone at all. But I used to go to a memory center to visit a friend. And not unlike Glenn Campbell and what his family had to work through during his last concert tour, but we had a gentleman in a band that I'm in and a brilliant musician. And he had a different form of dementia. And he ended up at this memory center. And, John, I've got to tell you that it really is so sad because on the walls in front of their rooms, you would see their life's stories.
Right.
So you might see somebody who was an Army veteran or a fashion designer. And the family would figure out a way to represent what their life was about. But I was really taken aback. I mean, I was there one day and I was walking the halls and I saw all this baseball memorabilia. And I saw the fact that this gentleman was someone known to me. And I'm not going to betray his, privacy, but it was somebody who was on a World Series team, literally.
Wow.
And there you saw a lot of emblems of past days and great glory. And so it can happen to anyone. I mean, it really can. So not to kid about it.
I don't know.
Anyway.
I think that's the worst, at least for your family. I mean, I don't know about for the people, but I mean, it's the worst thing to go when your relatives don't recognize you anymore. And
yeah.
It's sad.
I mean, in fact, my friend rejected other bandmates and myself when we would go over toward the end. And he would say, go away. And it was very agitated just by our presence. And very, very sad. And we lost him earlier this year. And so none of us knows what's going to be happening to us in
sure.
the next day, let alone 2025. But we do our best with this program to try to extrapolate where are we headed as a society. And we cannot do anything more important than imagining what our digital lives are going to be like because, John, they're becoming so entwined with our real lives.
I know. It's kind of scary what's going on. I mean, you know, your smart house and now we're talking about robots, that artificial intelligence and self-driving cars. I mean, it's just...
And I'll tell you, the one that really perplexes me is the whole notion that somebody could get some emotional gratification from having sex with a robot.
I know. That's
I've
bizarre.
Read about this. I just don't understand it at all.
It's bizarre. It is bizarre stuff, but I guess to each his own, I suppose.
I guess. Well, if our digital lives continue to grow in the way that we imagine, John, this episode is really important because what we're talking about in this episode is the fact that there are ways now, and I don't quite understand this, and I think you would probably be better at explaining this, that perhaps without malice or forethought, or maybe just a pinch of that, but more because people are doing harm in ways that they don't even recognize in Silicon Valley because of who they are and their worldview and the fact that most of them are white males, that in fact, if we look at a lot of the software, a lot of the filters, they are rather biased. And I had never contemplated this, but you actually experienced something like
this.
Well,
I mean, I've seen it. I've seen the apps where they make you look like a somebody from Asia and they give you the buck teeth and, you know, they, you know, I mean, I've seen that and, you know, but I never looked at it as really biased, but I guess, I mean, if you really examine it, when I saw it, I thought it was pretty funny.
But I thought you said that there was a filter that was used on photographs that really did misrepresent.
Well, it does. It does. I mean, if you really look at it, it does. It really, you know, I guess it, what's the word I'm looking for? It, you know, all those
distorts or distorts, amplifies, you know,
right,
various features.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
You know, it gives you the buck teeth and the squinty eyes and, you know.
And that goes back to the old Charlie Chan notion.
Right, right.
If we're talking about Asians here.
Yeah.
Well, there is a book out called Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. And I was taken aback that there are things, for example, and we know that this is in the news a lot about rape and domestic violence and the like, that in fact, Siri is not programmed. If somebody's trying to go up on Siri to say, I'm in danger, somehow that doesn't get translated or recognized.
Yeah.
And I guess the sense is, well, if you've got a lot of white male guys in Silicon Valley who are programming this stuff, can they really understand this or really be alert to the concerns that might be raised by a woman who, in fact, is looking for that help by way of Siri?
Well, you know, another thing, though, I mean, on the plus side of that, they found that they have the, what's it called, in the house, I have a Google Mini and stuff. They actually record what's going on there, and they solve some murders using that.
Okay, so conversely, some of this technology can be used for those purposes.
I mean, it's kind of spooky because you think about it, it's recording everything that you say in your house. So on the negative side, it's kind of spooky, but on the positive side, they were able to solve a murder or two.
Heard it misrepresenting what is taking place in a home? There could be a dispute that is not violent, but is a dispute.
No, I haven't heard that. I just heard that they used, you know, it to solve and I don't know I know if you say, hey, Google, or if you know, whatever the other ones are, that, you know, they wake up and it is listening. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess there's a good and a bad side to some of this technology.
Well, according to the author that we're going to have on in a moment, Sarah Wachter Bocher, she indicates that there is a lot of insensitivity that's having an impact on our digital lives. So, for example, you've got registration forms online that you have to fill things out. And so if you put John or I put Larry, it recognizes those names.
Right.
But it does block some non-Western names, doesn't recognize them. Wait a minute, that can't be right. I've seen that happen on my Apple iPhone, where you type in something, and because it doesn't recognize it, it spits it back. And you're saying, well, how do I get around this? Because I need to communicate something.
Right. That happens.
There's also a criminal risk assessment software that evidently singles out blacks as a greater risk to be repeat offenders. So it does take certain things into account that were at least programmed into something based upon biases.
Right. Maybe how they did their algorithms to wow.
Well, you know that Sarah has a lot to say about this issue, and she does it in very clear terms so we can all understand it. And I think she's trying to build a lot more sensitivity in Silicon Valley to the problems that result if they don't, number one, make culturally more representative the teams that are building this stuff, or on the back end, once the app is made or once the program is built, it can have unintended consequences if you haven't taken into account some of the variables in our society in terms of who we are.
Right. Well, this sounds very interesting.
Well, she's going to join us. And again, we'll strip it all away, explain what it is that she's worried about. The book is called Technically Wrong. Sarah Wachter Bocher is with us, and she has written a wonderful book about something that I never really thought about, really. It's called Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Now, I've got to tell you, Sarah,
where you really touch me in terms of my perception of the way these technologists build these incredible things that we are all now so dependent upon was when my wife decided that her Siri was going to be an Aussie gentleman. And it just never felt quite right to me that he was the one who was going to be her virtual assistant. And that's one of the things that you're trying to remind us of in terms of some of the biases that are built in to the technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I think personal assistants are really interesting because so many of them default to being a woman's voice. And that's the kind of the standard. And, you know, I think we often use these things without really breaking down, well, why is that? Why is it we're more comfortable with having a woman be our personal assistant? And then you think about, well, because we've got a long history of putting women into sort of helper roles and secretarial roles. And so, you know, we tend to think of that as being more natural somehow. And it's not to say that everybody needs to change the voice that they have on Siri necessarily, but I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, in many, many ways, the technology that we have, it's not neutral. I mean, it's just as influenced by humans as anything else we touch.
You remind us not only the output in terms of Siri's voice and gender, but that Siri's responses to a series of queries you find to be biased. And you want to remind us that Siri is programmed by human beings.
So that's an interesting case. In a study last year in JAMA Internal Medicine, so that's from the Journal of the American Medical Association, there was a study about how smartphone assistants, and that's Siri, Cortana, and a bunch of others as well, they're just not programmed to help people during crisis or stressful moments. They tend to not have an answer for questions that are related to things like domestic violence or sexual assault, and even a lot of different health concerns that may require emergency care. And as the researchers were going through and looking at this, what they realized was that oftentimes Siri would actually respond with something that was kind of jokey. So I tested this out a little bit myself, and I got some of those joke responses. If you, you know, asked Siri what to do after you'd been sexually assaulted, she might just kind of give you a little snappy, witty comeback. And, of course, Siri doesn't actually know what exactly I'm talking about. Siri doesn't know that I'm in crisis. But I think what's really telling is that, you know, you've got a team that has invested a lot of time and resources into programming Siri to be able to tell jokes, and yet they never considered programming Siri to be able to respond if somebody has a crisis query. It wasn't something that they had in mind at all.
You remind us that as an industry, it doesn't really think about who's being served by its products and who's being left behind, alienated, or insulted. I mean, are they cavalier about this? Is it just it's so dominated by young, smart, white guys out in Silicon Valley? What's going on here?
Well, you know, I think there's a bunch of different problems happening. And I have worked with many, many wonderful people in tech, including people at some of these big tech companies and startups that I talk about, and they're not necessarily bad people. However, you know, it is not an industry that's known for its diversity. You've probably heard about all of the stories this summer about sexual harassment in Silicon Valley, about venture capitalists harassing women who were trying to seek funding. There's been tons of stuff coming out.
Well, when I can get away from Hollywood and Washington, then I focus on Silicon Valley, yeah.
Sure. It's like one in the long list. So it's not an industry that is known to being particularly welcoming to women. It's also an industry that is very, very, very white. In fact, there's a perception that a lot of Asian folks work in Silicon Valley, and that's true, but there was even a study last week from the Ascend Foundation that looked at employment data from like 2005 to 2017, and they noted that even though Asian men are very likely to get hired, they're actually the least likely to get promoted. So it is an industry that's very much run by one dominant group, and that certainly plays a role. And then I think when you couple that with a lot of the sort of golden child mentality that exists in Silicon Valley, because they've been told for so long that they're the best and the brightest, that it's a meritocracy and they're there because, you know, they are geniuses. I think what you get is people who are not trained to think about people different than themselves and not incentivized to do it, and can really easily get into this very paternalistic mindset where, you know, tech knows best.
And somebody might be listening to this saying, well, what's the big deal here? But when you think about it, that these designers of search engine software algorithms, they are really our portal to so many important things in our lives and direct us to information and approaches that we take as gospel because, well, we rely upon them and think of them as these technological marvels. So this is serious when you're looking at the fact that we now are so dependent upon them and their thinking.
Yes, precisely. I think it's one thing to say, oh, well, so, you know, Facebook did this thing that was a little insensitive, or Siri couldn't handle this query in their crisis and told a joke. Okay, maybe that's not a big deal. But the problem is when you start writing off those little things, then you have tech companies that continue to do more and more and more that embeds itself in our lives, including a huge amount of the technology that we use today that's being driven by algorithms and artificial intelligence. And so the same biases that are present in a small way in something like Siri get embedded in a much deeper way the more that we rely on algorithms and AI to drive our technology. And that's already happening right now.
Well, it sounds to me in many ways like Wall Street. When you look at it, you say gobs of money, little public scrutiny, they do whatever they want. And that's what we allowed to happen on Wall Street. So if we're allowing that to happen in Silicon Valley, what are some of the implications of that?
Right. I do think there's a lot of parallels. And I would look at that and say, you know, is that what you want, right? Is that the kind of industry that you want, another Wall Street? And I think where it's a little bit different is just in it has some different impacts on society. And so the kinds of impacts that we're really starting to look at are technology that is holding power over things like, you know, whether or not you're going to get hired for a job, holds power over things like there's software that decides how risky you are for crime if you've been arrested for something. There's
the predictive technologies, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And then there's also, you know, tons of software that's affecting us on a daily basis. I mean, just look at, for example, the current Facebook scandal in the news over the Russian-backed organizations that bought all of the advertising on Facebook last year during the election. I mean, that's just now kind of coming out and really starting to be better understood. But Facebook allowed, you know, thousands of ads to go live that were from these Russian-backed organizations that were patently designed to flare up tensions in America and unsettle democracy. I mean, tech is really powerful, and that power extends into sort of the, you know, our personal emotional state, into the social fabric of our communities and our culture, and into our political lives, too.
And what was really upsetting to me as it relates to Facebook, they never even wanted to acknowledge that they had been used in this way. It took a lot of great reporting to dig this out, and they like to say, well, we're just this platform, and we just let all these voices in. But they're more than a platform in terms of the way that they determine what I see and how they can personalize information getting to me or to you.
Absolutely. I think that that's a case of very much, you know, you want to have your cake and eat it too. You want to say that we can have this tremendous control over what people see and how people are tracked and tagged and targeted, and we can make a lot of money off of them, but we also want to have zero responsibility for the things that we let have happen, you know? And I think that you shouldn't be able to have it both ways. And for too long, we've really let tech companies have it both ways. And I think that that's really what we need to push back against.
I mean, are we just in awe of what they do? We think they're just so darn smart, and we just figure that they've got to have a cultural sensitivity to the impact that their technology is having throughout our culture. Is that why we give them a pass, or maybe we just don't understand what they do, and we assume that we're just not bright enough to figure this out, but they are?
I think that's part of it, and if you had asked me a couple of years ago if we were just in awe of technology, I would have had a quicker yes to that, because I think that I would talk to people who really were in awe of technology, and simultaneously, technology made them feel stupid, right? Like, they didn't understand it was hard to use, or they were really enjoying using something like Facebook or Twitter, but didn't really feel like they got it, and I think that that's by design. Like, technology companies have wanted us to feel a little bit mystified, because it prevents us from asking too many tough questions. Now, the reason I say that I would have said we would have been in awe 2 years ago is that I'm actually starting to see that break a bit. You know, I think that the election last year and then the events of 2017 and how much those have been intertwined with things like social media platforms has created a lot more space for tech criticism. And I'm really glad about that because I think it's long overdue.
You say to us that we need to read the terms of service agreements, which none of us really can do. And John, my partner, is smiling here because he's technically very savvy. But who reads this? Honestly, why should we?
Oh, you know, I don't know that I would say that you should sit down and read all the terms of service agreements because I don't know that anybody can. I don't know that you can even understand them if you did, right? They're all written in legalese. I'm frustrated by the complexity of them and by what's bound up in them. And I do think it's worth paying closer attention, absolutely, to what you're signing up for. I think it's hard to expect anybody, though, to, you know, read 5,000 words of legal jargon in order to download an app. But I do really recommend that people watch for certain signals. Like, for example, if it's something that you're downloading onto your phone, that your phone is an excellent location tracker, right? So if it's asking you, you know, to share location data, it wants to know where you are, I would definitely pause and be like, well, wait a second, does this app actually need to know where I am? If it's Maps, sure, yeah, Maps needs to know where I am. That's the purpose of Maps. But most of the products that we're using, you know, you don't necessarily need to track as much as they want to track. So I always kind of ask people to take a look at some of that and, you know, and also consider if it's something that you don't really feel comfortable with and you can go without. I don't think deleting is necessarily a bad idea. I think that gets harder and harder the more kind of important the tech product is to our lives. Like something like, you know, Facebook would be really hard for a lot of people to delete because it is kind of their window to their community, their family, et cetera. But yeah, I do think just kind of being a little bit more cautious and a little bit more ready to, you know, choose something better where there is a better product, right? Like, I mean, choosing even Lyft over Uber, for example, is a relatively easy choice to make, and you're choosing a company that is, by all counts, substantially better.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two, and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
You know, in public education, they've changed the way they looked at let's get everybody in and let's give them the information. What happens to them? Well, you know, it's up to them. Now, of course, with No Child Left Behind and all these measurements, we're trying to say that we want proficiency from everyone. And yet we're still confused about playing to the middle in public education. Now, let's assume that they're becoming a new form of public education every moment, all the technology that we have. have, and we're storing so much information thanks to them. This use of personas when developing these new apps or products, the normal person, I mean, are they required in their own thinking to find that norm, what's normative in our culture, or can they be a lot more allowing in terms of an understanding of the diversity of this culture?
So I think that personas are really interesting, and that personas are meant to be a design tool. And for people who aren't familiar with them, a persona is basically like a write-up of a fake person that you would use to think about when you're making design decisions. And originally, like personas, as they're meant to be used, is meant to be a tool to help you think about people when you're designing. What ended up happening in a lot of tech companies is that a lot of kind of extra detail about like demographics and all of these things to make somebody seem real get baked into these documents. And they also get really hyper-targeted on, as you've said, to some sort of, imaginary average person or ideal user. And when that happens, what you end up with is actually a tool that is supposed to make you better at serving people, but can actually make you worse at it because you start focusing all of your energy on this mythical person. So I always try to help people understand that a persona is a tool that can be used really well, and to make it better, you need to make sure that it represents a broader range of people, a broader range of needs, and a broader range of perspectives, and that by purposely going beyond, one really narrow idea, you can actually find flaws in your product a lot more quickly.
You bring up this case of a face morphing filter that Snapchat used. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Snapchat, I use from time to time myself. Like many people, I love it for sending messages to my nieces. I can put on a flower crown or have hearts floating up the screen. But Snapchat also has a history of releasing some insensitive photo filters. A couple in particular were one that they called an anime filter. And what the anime filter did not look like any actual anime movie you may have seen. It gave your selfie squinty eyes, buck teeth, slanty eyebrows, and it looked like an Asian stereotype. And pretty quickly, people were calling that a yellow face filter, which is the term for somebody dressing up as an Asian person who's not actually Asian. And it was pretty offensive. And what was really frustrating about that filter was that just a few months before that, Snapchat had actually done something really similar. They had released a filter that they called Bob Marley. It was on April 20th, which is known as, 420, which is the marijuana holiday. And it was the Bob Marley filter that would make your skin dark and give you dreadlocks. And when that happened, people immediately said, this is digital blackface. This isn't cool. You don't put on blackface in real life, and you shouldn't put it on in an app either. And so it was really disappointing to have Snapchat hear that feedback, and then basically do the same thing again with Asian culture.
These default settings, who are they built for?
Well, I think typically when you take a look at who is behind these products, and particularly at senior levels, you're mostly talking about your, straight white men. And that's really the bulk of who is in Silicon Valley even still, even despite a lot of talk about diversity. That's the reality. And I think that, the majority of those folks don't necessarily intend to make their products exclusive to only people like them, but because they haven't explicitly done the work of figuring out how to make them more inclusive to others, and they haven't brought other people into the process, that's what ends up happening, is things tend to default toward the people who made it. And that's a really narrow segment of society that's just not reflective of, most Americans, much less most people.
I was kind of stunned, Sarah, I've got to tell you, by what you described as an obsession with youth and whiteness in this Silicon Valley culture. And you're talking about folks having plastic surgery in their 30s because they wanted to look 20-something. Is that really going on?
So that's like a constant rumor, and I hear that all over the place. Now, whether it's even happening or not is so almost less interesting than the fact that this is something people keep talking about, that there's so much pressure on being the typical successful startup story. That's what venture capitalists are looking for. They want to see people who seem to them like people who have done well in the past, right? So you want to put your money on the next Mark Zuckerberg. And, well, they start conflating things because they start thinking, oh, well, next Mark Zuckerberg equals next 22-year-old white guy in a hoodie, as opposed to thinking about, you know, what are the ideas, what are the actual product features they're talking about, or what are the traits about this person that makes you think they're going to be successful. And so when you start conflating sort of like actual talent or genius or whatever you want to call it with youth and with somebody being a guy who looks like all the other guys before him, then yeah, it's not surprising you get this really warped sense in that industry and in that culture that says, oh, well, I should make sure that I look young because that's who they're going to want to fund.
You do remind us that this technology really does undergird so much in our lives today that we need to understand if there's some bias built into this. And let's take a real practical example. You talk about courts using software algorithms to influence criminal sentencing. Now, tell us how that works and what the built-in biases could mean to different cultural types.
Yeah, so in that particular example, I look at some investigations that ProPublica did last year into software called Compass that's made by a company called Northpoint. And what Compass does is it assigns risk scores to defendants who have been accused of a crime. And that risk score is supposed to indicate how likely that person is to commit a crime again in the future. And those risk scores are assigned by algorithm. The way that happens is that the algorithm will look at a defendant's past criminal history, and it will also look at information like how they grew up. It'll ask them questions. So you do an interview process, and there's questions like, did you move around a lot as a child? Or has anybody in your family ever been to prison? All of these questions that really essentially create a scenario where people who are black in the United States are much more likely to end up getting a higher score. And so black people have a higher on average score using this software. And if you think that the past had perfectly unbiased criminal justice, then maybe that would be fine. But the only reason you make software like this in the first place is that you realize that there's a problem with bias in the past in how people were being accused and convicted of crimes. And so what you end up doing is you end up creating an algorithm that recreates the past, right? So it takes that past data about, so if you are black, you're much more likely to have been incarcerated, which means that if you come from a black family, you are much more likely to have somebody in your family who has been incarcerated, which means you're going to answer that question in a way that's different than a typical white person, which means you're going to end up with a higher score. And so you then recreate the cycle that already existed that led to that higher rate of black incarceration in the first place. And what ProPublica found was that the algorithm had specifically much worse outcomes for black people, in that a huge percentage of people who were rated high risk and who were black did not reoffend, much larger than for white people. And then conversely, if you were white and you got a low risk score, you are much more likely to reoffend than if you were black and got a low risk score. So basically, the system gets it wrong some percentage of the time. But the problem is that the system gets it wrong in a way that harms black people and tends to help white people.
The book is called Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech by Sarah Wachter Becker. And Sarah, you point out also that there's lots in the culture that is a misfit when it comes to some of these technological advances. And you use as one example this smartwatch and Fatima, I'm not certain how it's pronounced, but help us to understand that story.
Yeah, so Fatima works at a innovation center in Silicon Valley. So it's like a big company, has a little Silicon Valley hub where it's trying to do something interesting. And she was a design researcher who was working on this smartwatch product supposed to be aimed at women. And the whole idea of the product was that it was going to be kind of a mid-range, you know, buy it at Macy's sort of product. And she was supposed to help figure out what it really needed to include, what were the key features. And she goes into the first meeting for this project, and she looks around, and it's nothing but men in the room. And then they start talking, and the entire conversation is just geared toward, you know, well, my wife likes this, and my wife likes that. And nobody really wanted to listen to the research. So even as she went out and talked to lots of women and found really key insights, like that, for example, one of the top things that they said they really needed out of a smartwatch was a way to subtly keep track of what was going on while they were in a meeting. So they didn't want to be looking at their phones, but they wanted to be able to know that they could get an alert for something important, especially the ones who are moms who said things like, if daycare is calling or if I get some kind of urgent text from daycare, I need to be able to see that, but I don't want people to know that I'm hanging out monitoring my phone for that sort of thing. And instead, you know, she goes back and she shares these insights with all of the other men on the project, and they just keep insisting, like, no, 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 that's not important. That's not important. And eventually the project just kind of flopped. They brought in a celebrity to help market the thing, and it was all based on stereotypes, and nobody wanted to buy it because it wasn't based on what people actually wanted and needed, and they didn't have a compelling story for the product.
Do you think that there are enough people who are affected by some of these biases to really change the culture and the approach to the development of these new products? Or have we just, again, you know, laid down in front of these technologists and said, you know, we are in your service and we are amazed at what you do? I mean, are people starting to rise up against some of this?
I think people are starting to rise up. I hope. You know, I still have some hope here that we have not just laid down to the tech industry. I think we can certainly push back, and I think we are really starting to see that happen. I think now is also the time because the industry has realized, it's definitely realized that it is not infallible. I think that that's been a wake-up call this past year. There's been report after report of the ways that our tech industry is, you know, vulnerable to people who want to misuse it. And that created, I think, some space to start having what I think is a really important cultural conversation about what do we want and what do we demand from tech companies and from the technology that we use.
Would the Uber culture be representative of some of those concerns?
The culture at Uber?
Yeah.
You know, I think that the culture at Uber is sort of often used, even in the tech industry, it's sort of like the joke without a punchline. Like, everybody knows that the Uber culture is almost like all of the worst things about Silicon Valley wrapped into one. And so I do think that that's one of the things that really has to change. They have this culture that's really all about, you know, very aggressive, hard driving, always be hustling is one of the things that they used to say. And it kind of went up in flames a bit. They had tons of allegations of sexual harassment in their offices. They had a lot of pushback against what was considered by some to be, you know, effectively strike-breaking when there was a taxi strike in New York during the first attempted implementation of a Muslim ban, and a whole other series of scandal after scandal after scandal that led to the CEO, Travis Kalanick, being removed. And I think that there's still a long way to go for a company like Uber to redeem itself, and there's, in fact, a lot of problems with their entire business model, which I think can be really abusive to the drivers in that system. But it's reassuring to see that real pushback can happen and can make change.
You remind us that throughout the book we meet people and companies that do try to change things. You've got the neighborhood-based community site that reduced racist posts, a news organization bucking journalism's trend towards shock, and then the email marketing platform that focused on empathetic communication rather than peppy pitches. So is the change going to come from the bottom or from the top? Because you also talk about Slack disrupting the tech culture. So where's the impetus for this change?
You know, I think that at best it needs to come from both. I think that there are lots of things that individual people can do who work inside tech, and I definitely spend a lot of my time talking to them about how to make change and how to start to change perceptions and attitudes. And then at the more macro level, I think that we can see change come from the top in some bigger ways when there is a large public outcry or when there's discussion of regulation. The tech industry has avoided a lot of regulation, and I think that there's starting to be some real discussion about when and how that becomes necessary.
you remind us that we need to be a lot more active in this and not passive, that we've got to know our products, we've got to demand the best and make certain that they're suiting our various needs, change brands if we need to, and maybe the Silicon guys are going to then get it right. What would you say to somebody listening today to this podcast, and they've noticed some of these things, but you've really heightened their sensitivity? What would you say to them?
You know, I would say that it's easy to feel overwhelmed by all of it and to feel like you can't change anything, or that the only solution is, well, you got to delete the app, right? Like, if you don't like it, delete it. Those are your choices. I think, however, that the other option is to say, you know, I'm going to be more critical of this and more aware of this, even if I'm going to keep using it. And as part of that, I'm going to push back. I'm going to tell a company when it's overreaching. I'm going to ask for change. I'm going to let them know that this isn't okay. I'm going to share that message with my friends. And I think that feels small in a lot of ways, but it is really only when we start having, you know, a loud and large number of people who say, no, this isn't okay, that we start to see change happen and we start to see larger bodies take interest.
So, folks, if there's something disturbing you about the way you're interacting with technology, whether it's some insensitivity for these photo filters or ride-hailing apps that you think are biased, whatever it may be, act up and act out. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends Podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of America Trends.